A close cabinet ally of Keir Starmer, Pat McFadden, has insisted the Prime Minister should remain in post, warning that removing him would cost the UK's economy and reputation. The Conservatives have called for a vote of no confidence in Keir over his decision to appoint Lord Mandelson as the UK's ambassador to the US in 2024. Peter Mandelson's being investigated by the police over allegations he sent sensitive government documents to Jeffrey Epstein while a cabinet minister. He hasn't commented, but BBC News understands his position is that he hasn't acted in any way criminally. Speaking on Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, Pat McFadden defended Keir Starmer's handling of the affair and insisted he should stay on as Prime Minister.
My thoughts in all of this are for the victims of what Jeffrey Epstein was doing. I've been absolutely appalled by seeing the emails that I've seen in the past week, but I believe that the Prime Minister is a man of good faith. I think he should have the support of the party, the parliamentary party, and should continue in his job.
Exit polls following Japan's general election suggest that the party of the new Prime Minister, Sunae Takaichi, has regained a majority in the lower house of parliament. If the results are confirmed, it would be a huge victory for Ms. Takaichi, who's Japan's first female Prime Minister. The security services in Russia say a man suspected of shooting a general in Moscow on Friday has been arrested in Dubai. Vladimir Alexeyev, who's Russia's deputy head of military intelligence, was wounded in the attack. Officials say the suspect will be extradited to Russia. The parents of two sisters killed in the 1989 Hillsborough disaster are calling for a change to official court records, which said the teenagers didn't suffer during the crush which killed 97 Liverpool fans. Later proceedings established that Sarah and Vicky Hicks didn't fall unconscious in seconds, as was first suggested. Police in Switzerland say a makeshift memorial for the victims of the deadly New Year's fire in Crans-Montana itself caught fire earlier today. 41 people died at the Constellation Bar in the ski resort town. Officers say firefighters were able to quickly bring the memorial fire under control. And the weather today, mild and generally cloudy with the occasional sunny spell and patchy rain. Temperatures reaching highs of 12 Celsius in London, 11 in Cardiff, 9 in Belfast and 10 in Edinburgh. BBC News, now it's time for Private Passions.
Richard Stokes has been passionate about song since he was a teenager, although, as he readily admits, he's not a great singer. Instead, he's become one of the world's leading authorities on German art songs, or Lieder, and has also co-written books on English, French and Spanish songs. His work as a translator includes the complete Bach cantatas and the complete songs of Hugo Wolf, as well as operas by Wagner and Berg. He's also collaborated with the pianist, the late Alfred Brendel, on translations of his poetry. Since 2006, he's coached young singers at the Royal Academy of Music in London, where he's Professor of Lieder. Your choice, Richard, does of course include the odd song, but you brought us Bach, Mahler, Stravinsky, and to begin, a recording made almost 80 years ago by Kathleen Ferrier.
Yes, my parents were quite astute. They liked music and realised that I was musical, and Dad would bring back records from work. Dad was an accountant, and he brought back records. I remember them vividly. There was Emmy Gilels playing the Emperor Concerto. There was Wilhelm Furtwängler conducting the Pastoral Symphony of Beethoven, and vocal music. There was Lisa della Casa singing Dove Sono from Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, which blew my mind. But best of all was Kathleen Ferrier and this recording from Gluck's Orfeo, What is Life to Me Without Thee? I didn't realise that it was a translation then. I didn't know it was originally Italian, but I adored the voice, and she coloured text so wonderfully. What is left if thou art dead? She almost pre-voices, hardens her tone on dead. And on the cover was this portrait by Lotte Meitner-Graf, that wonderful Austrian photographer who fled the Nazis in black and white. So it was a double whammy. I fell in love with the voice and her face.
Fascinating the way Gluck twists the knife towards the end by repeating certain lines and then taking them up.
Exactly, and she responds to that so beautifully. I mean, it's real despair at the end. It's not just beautiful. And I love the way each time the great tune is reprised, it's at a different dynamic level. So piano, pianissimo, and then pianissimo. It's Yeah. It's amazing. Wonderful singing, fantastic diction.
We heard the great English contralto, Kathleen Ferrier, recorded in 1946 in Orfeo's Act III aria from Gluck's Orpheus Eurydice, Malcolm Sargent conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. You mentioned, Richard Stokes, your life beginning in Nottingham in 1945. So were your parents musical?
My parents liked music very much. My father preferred big symphonies and concerti. My mother actually had a really rather lovely voice, and I remember her singing some German folk songs from this album that her German teacher at school must have given her, and I wonder whether that might not have been the seed that sowed my love. They were lovely parents. They gave us a very good upbringing, but they sent us away aged 8 to boarding school, and I think we weren't perhaps always happy there. But sport is what saved us, really. Our family were obsessed with sport. My mother played hockey for England in 1950, 51, 52, and I remember going on training runs with her around Mappley Park in Nottingham. Humphrey, my brother Humphrey, who died 40 years ago, he played hockey for England under 23. I played a huge amount of competitive tennis.
That's a passion we share, but I think you got a little further than me, Junior Wimbledon.
Well, yes, but I didn't get very far in Junior Wimbledon. I did play in Junior Wimbledon 1 year and lost very heavily. But sport still means a huge amount to me. I mean, I'm a passionate European, but when it comes to sport, I'm so nationalistic, it's not very attractive.
You were at Repton School, and did you do well academically?
No, I was really struggled to start with. Still got my letters back home, how I find everything difficult. But then I started German, and I loved it. And I loved the sound of German. And German song soon came for me, you know, the chief interest in my life. And it was while I was at Repton that I heard on the radio Fischer Dieskau and Joan Moore performing Schubert's Der Neugierige from the Songcycle des Schöne Müllerin. I simply couldn't believe what I was hearing. A, I could understand it, and B, the beauty of his singing. I very rarely heard it performed as I hear it, and I think the problem is the first verse. It's marked langsam, so slowly. And if you sing it, perform it too slowly, there's no contrast with the very slowly that follows at O Bächlein, meine Liebe, which is the next section. And the words simply aren't romantic. You know, I'll ask no flower, I'll ask no star, they can't tell me what my heart wants to know. After all, I'm not a gardener. This is really conversational, and it's self-mockery. Ich bin ja auch kein Gärtner. I'm not a gardener, and the stars are too high, and then you can writ. Mein Bächlein will ich fragen, I'll ask my brooklet, ob mich mein Herz belog, whether my heart is deceiving me. And then the magic starts.
Frage keine Blume, ich frage keinen Stern. Sie können mir alle nicht sagen, was ich erführ so gern. Ich bin ja auch kein Gärtner. Die Sterne stehen zu hoch, mein Bächlein will ich fragen, ob mich mein Herz belohnt.
bist du heute so stumm? Will ja nur eines wissen, ein Wörtchen und das eine Wörtchen, das andere heißet nein. Die beiden Wörtchen schließen die ganze Welt mir ein. Die beiden Wörtchen schließen die ganze Welt mir ein. O Bächlein meiner Liebe, was sag, Bächlein, liebt sie mich? Sag, Bächlein, liebt sie mich?
As we were listening to that, I was thinking, it's not just the beauty of the voice, it's the sheer artistry.
It's incredible. The way he stresses things, will ja nur eines wissen, I want to know one thing alone.
We heard the baritone Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau accompanied by the great pianist Gerald Moore in their 1962 recording of Schubert's song cycle Die Schöne Müllerin, The Fair Maid of the Mill, of which that was the sixth song, Die Neugierige. How do you translate Neugierige?
Well, it's really difficult. Gierig is greedy. Neu is new, so you are greedy for something new, etymologically. The inquisitive one, it's not great. Der Neugierige is a lovely word. The inquisitive one is less good, I think.
Apart from your academic struggles, Richard Stokes, did you enjoy life at boarding school? I mean, how did it compare with the brutal portrayals of public school life in, for example, Roald Dahl's autobiography of his childhood, Boy?
Yes, and also Lindsay Anderson's film, If, which was filmed, I think, in 68, and I went to Repton in 63. Well, yes, I was happy, but partly because of sport. Repton was a difficult place then. Fagging still existed. Older boys could beat younger boys. Boxing had not yet been outlawed. It was brutal.
But did you find that sport got you through somehow?
Yes, it helped enormously. And then it all changed. In, I think it was 1962, John Thorne arrived, who later became headmaster of Winchester. And enormously quickly, the school became a much kinder place. He widened the interest in music and art. He invited boys into his drawing room in the evening to listen to gramophone records. I owe a huge amount to him, but also the music master, William Agnew, and his wife Jill. I was quite lonely at school, and their home on Sunday mornings was a sanctuary. William played us music that I had no idea existed, so Second Viennese School, so Schoenberg, Berg, Webern even.
Wow.
But what really went home to me was Stravinsky. He had the same effect on me, did Stravinsky, as Van Gogh did on me in art. My parents' home was full of Renaissance reproductions. Then suddenly, Van Gogh, the sort of blazing light of his colours. So in Stravinsky, I couldn't believe the lively rhythms, the exotic orchestration.
It's Petrushka, then.
It's Petrushka, and I love the evocation of the Shrovetide Fair and Russian peasants and the busyness of it.
Even if you didn't have this on the stage, the music conjures it up.
It's incredible.
It? The Shrovetide Fair, the opening of Stravinsky's ballet score Petrushka. Ernest Ansermet conducted the Suisse Romande Orchestra. Richard Stokes, after school you went to Oxford University to study French and German.
That's right. But it was also at Oxford I felt, well, perhaps I've got a voice. Perhaps I shall be the second Fischer Dieskau. So I rang this lady and asked her to give me a lesson. She said, yes, bring a song. So I brought Gute Nacht, the first song of Schubert's Winterreise. And she said, yes, I would like you to sing into this mirror. And so I sang, and she wanted to observe my posture. And so I sang into the mirror and gave what I thought then, in my arrogance, was the greatest performance ever of that great song, baritone or sheen, profound psychological penetration. And I was very moved by what I was doing. And I only looked up at the modulation to the major in the last verse, will dich im Traum nicht stören. And all I could see in the mirror was her back rippling with mirth. And that, Michael, was the end of my career. But it did teach me one thing, that however risible anybody is singing, you cannot do that. You have to find something positive. To say, but it was a great, huge, huge disappointment.
So did that teacher's reaction shape the way you now teach students?
Well, certainly I try and be positive, yeah. And it didn't put me off music at all. It was at Oxford that I discovered the late quartets of Beethoven. And I played the Amadeus Quartet, the Cavatina from Opus 130, over and over again. Starts with this wonderfully sad melody and then six bars of the most extraordinary music I think that he ever wrote. The three lower voices start pulsating and then the first violin, which I always associate with Beethoven himself, try to fashion this melody and it doesn't work. It's just fragmented. It's absolutely heartbreaking. And we're told by an eyewitness, his name is Karl Holz, that Beethoven composed this unter Tränen der Wehmut, with tears of sadness. So it's marked beklempt. It's the only marking in all music that I know that's marked oppressed or downhearted. I could not believe this great music. I wore out that track, playing it so many times on my old record player.
The Cavatina from Beethoven's String Quartet in B-flat, Opus 130, played by the Amadeus Quartet. You're listening to Private Passions on BBC Radio 3 with me, Michael Barclay, and my guest today, Richard Stokes, Professor of Leader at the Royal Academy of Music. After university, Richard, you worked as a German teacher in schools. I mean, was teaching a vocation for you?
Well, when I finished my degree and didn't really know what to do, and so I stayed on to take a certificate of education. So it was a temporising measure. And I'm not sure what else I could have done, but I love German and German music so much that I wanted to share that. So if that's a vocation, yes. And when I arrived at Westminster School, I suddenly thought that why don't I teach in my way instead of using these lame grammar books that spend 100 pages doing the present tense and condescend you with most appalling cartoons and invite you to play at post offices and banks and shopping centres. I mean, I just couldn't do it. So I started to teach through music, through cabaret, so Brecht, Weil, art song, arias from operas. I mean, if you take something like Erlkönig, the great ballad by Goethe that's set by Schubert and Karl Löwe, I mean, there's so much grammar there. There's present tense, there are other tenses, there's adjectival endings, there are cases. And it's memorable because it's written by a genius in a way that a grammar book can't be memorable. And I think that adolescents, they don't want to be treated like babies and cartoons. They want to get their teeth into something adult. And this was a way of doing that. And it was while I was at Westminster that I invited some of the world's greatest singers to come and sing in the school hall. Felicity Lott, Ian Bostred, Robert Hall, and Wolfgang Holzmeier. And Holzmeier was accompanied by Imogen Cooper. And then I asked Imogen, who had long been a friend, whether she would play the last three piano sonatas of Franz Schubert on one evening, and she'd never done it before, and to my amazement she said yes. I think all these people said they would perform because I couldn't give them much money, but it was before a predominantly young audience, and we crowded 300 or 400 people around the Steinway in a small room, and it really was special. And so Imogen played those three sonatas. And the way she played the Andantino from the penultimate sonata, to me, it's the loneliest music in all Schubert. And I've chosen not Imogen, but Alfred Brendel as a homage to him.
He taught her for a while, or she worked with him.
Well, exactly, Vienna. And his gradations of piano are extraordinary. And also the way he plays this middle section, has there been anything like it in music? Something cataclysmic occurs. All hell is let loose. You've got these manic trills. You've got these plunging intervals. And to me, it's Schubert facing death. You know, he had a few more months to live. And it's his terror. And I know that some people, including Alfred, actually, thinks that he had no idea that he was dying. Well, I think that when his syphilis was diagnosed in 1823, he must have known that that was a death sentence.
Thank you.
To me, it's horror, it's terror.
We heard the second movement, the Andantino, from Schubert's piano sonata, Deutsch 959, played by Alfred Brendel. We're going to reflect another element of Alfred's personality now, because he's a musician with whom you've worked on translation.
Yes, we started translating his poems for fun. He would do a version, and we would then meet for about 2 or 3 hours sometimes and argue, and I would change his idiom sometimes, and we would search together for the mots justes. It was such fun. And eventually we must have translated about 150 or 200 in a dual language book.
Because he wrote poetry in German.
He wrote poetry in German, and he told me that he didn't actually write them. They came to him. Some are really serious. There's one about Beethoven's Opus 111, where the pianist levitates at the moment you get those trills as evidence that an event of mystical significance is going on, and the piano plays by itself. It's a zany, extraordinary poem. But there are witty poems like The Coffers of Cologne, which is my favourite. I'll read it in our translation, but the German is much, much better. Alfred wrote this poem because he performed often at the Cologne Philharmonie with amazing acoustic, but every sniffle and cough was audible. So he wrote this poem, and it goes like this. The coffers of Cologne have joined forces with the Cologne Clappers and established the Cough and Clap Society, a non-profit-making organisation whose aim it is to guarantee each concert-goer's right to a cough and applaud. Attempts by unfeeling artists or impresarios to question such privileges have led to a coffers and clappers initiative. Members are required to applaud immediately after sublime coders and cough distinctly during expressive silences. Distinct coughing is of paramount importance. To stifle or muffle it, forbidden on pain of expulsion. Coffers of outstanding tenacity are awarded the coughing Rhine maiden, the handsome if slightly baroque appendage to be worn around the neck. The CNC's recent merger with the New York Sneezers and the London Whistlers raises high hopes for Cologne's musical future.
Many artists have been plagued by that kind of thing. So you obviously got on well with Alfred. He had a very mischievous side to him, didn't he?
He's very mischievous, and his laugh was quite unlike anybody else's laugh. It was zany, and it was a sort of guttural outburst. It was great fun, but it was very serious at the same time. That's a lovely mixture.
I'm Michael Barclay, and you're listening to Private Passions on BBC Radio 3 with my guest today, Richard Stokes, who's Professor of Lieder at the Royal Academy of Music. Richard, your next music is a song by Ilse Weber, the Jewish poet and composer who was murdered in Auschwitz. What brought you to choose this?
If you teach German, it's really important to deal with the 12 dark years of German history. Ilse Weber wrote 60 poems in Theresienstadt, where she was imprisoned. And we have eyewitness accounts of how she actually sang to her guitar to the children as they were being led to the gas chambers. And this song called Ich wandere durch Theresienstadt, it's sung by Anselm von Otter, and it deals with what it's like to be, I wander through the camp and wish I could go home. They've taken home, they've taken away our home. Wann wohl das Leid ein Ende hat? When will all this suffering end? And on Holocaust Day at the Royal Academy of Music, I have two classes. We listen to Anselm von Otter sing this, and then we all sing it together in chorus. It's heartbreaking.
Ich wandere durch Theresienstadt, das Herz so schwer wie Blei, bis je mein Weg ein Ende hat, bis je
The mezzo-soprano Anne-Sophie von Otter performed the Ilse Weber song I Wander Through Theresienstadt, accompanied by the pianist Bengt Forsberg and the accordion player Bebe Risenfors. Richard Stokes, you haven't only translated songs and poetry, you've also written and published translations of works by the late 19th and early 20th century Jewish Czech writer Franz Kafka. Was there something about his work that drew you to him?
Well, I started to teach him at Westminster School because I wanted texts that weren't babyish, that were adult, and that adolescents could actually relate to. And they do relate to the theme of the outsider and estrangement and suffering. There's an anecdote called Gib's Auf, Give Up. It's linguistically so simple that anyone in the first year of studying German can learn it. And they learned it by heart. Mm-hmm. And I think if you learn something by heart like that, not just memorize it, but internalize it, you have it for life. And there's so much grammar within it. So Kafka's meant a lot to me.
You've also translated several operas into English for performances at Opera North and English National Opera. Does opera translation differ much from song?
Yes, hugely, if it's to be a sung translation. My translations of Lieder, they're no more than a line-to-line equivalents, and although I prefer green grass to verdant sward, I try and render poetic colour. But that's much easier than translating for opera. There are problems like this that... If you take Parsifal, which I translated for ENO, as you've given an example, Parsifal shoots the swan, and Gunnermann says, why did you do this? Where do you come from? Who's your father? And he says to each one, das weiß ich nicht. That know I not. Easy to translate? No. Old-fashioned, I know not that. You know, that gives opera such a bad name. And Mark Elder, the conductor and I, wondered what to do about this. And we changed the music. It's recitative, sort of, anyway. Mm. And so why do you do this? I don't know. And Felix Mottl's stage directions imply that he answers as a scolded adolescent boy. Don't know. I actually asked my daughters at breakfast one day how what they would do, because they were studying German. And they say, oh, I don't know. Of course, that could have been syllabically perfect, but it doesn't quite work.
You've chosen the chilling murder scene from Berg's Wozzeck, which you translated for Deborah Warner's Opera North production in the 1990s, your first opera translation. Berg wrote the libretto himself, based on the unfinished play by Georg Büchner, and the opera starkly portrays the everyday lives of soldiers and inhabitants in a rural town, exploring themes of militarism, sadism, brutality. Why did you want to do this opera?
As a challenge, and it meant so much to me. It's such a humane work. So it was the humanity, I think, that drew me to... I mean, Wozzeck is intelligent, but he's not, hasn't the gift of the gab, whereas everybody else has the gift of the gab, and that's all. He's more intelligent than they, but cannot express it. It moved me. There's a wonderful letter that Büchner wrote to his parents. I despise nobody, because it lies in nobody's power not to become a criminal or not to become a drunkard. It's fate. You cannot do anything about it.
Dort links geht's in die Stadt. Es ist noch weit, komm schneller.
Du sollst da bleiben, Marie. Komm, setz dich.
Aber ich muss fort.
Bist weit gegangen, Marie. Sollst dir die Füße nicht mehr. Noch Marie, wie lang es jetzt ist, dass wir uns kennen.
Zu Pfingsten 3 Jahre.
Und was meinst, wie lang es noch dauern wird?
Ich muss fort.
Fürcht dich, Marie, und bist doch fromm und gut.
Music from Act 3, Scene 2 of Alban Berg's Vorzeck. We heard the soprano, Evelyn Lear, and the baritone Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau with the orchestra of Deutsche Oper Berlin, conducted by Karl Böhm. Richard Stokes, in 2006, you were asked to join the vocal faculty of the Royal Academy of Music in London. As a non-performing musician, how easy was it to fit in?
Well, I was greatly supported by teachers there, and I've never worked in such a simulating environment. I really love students. I'm neither a musician nor musicologist. I best describe perhaps as an enthusiast. And my chief task, I suppose, is to get them to enthuse for these works, and particularly the poetry. They have not just to memorize it, but they have to own it, to inhabit it, and to be able to recite it. There's a wonderful anecdote, Hugo Wolf. There's an eyewitness account by this musicologist called Richard Batke. Wolf was performing a Mörike song, Auf einer Wanderung, and he would very often recite the poem before performing it. I wish that would happen more today. Anyway, Batke tells us that he recited this poem in a Styrian accent, and then he turned to the audience and said, in English first, "Isn't the poem screamingly beautiful? Ist das Gedicht nicht zum Heulen schön?" So that's what I really try and get the students to achieve, you know, do they understand the poem and what words to stress? Breathing you can help with. Where do you breathe in song? You can breathe where you like as long as you make it work, but being a Germanist and a grammarian, I sometimes like breathing to be grammatical. And there's a very famous example from the Magic Flute, Mozart's Magic Flute, when Sarastro says, "O Isis und Osiris." So where do you breathe? So many conductors, they say musical reasons, they conduct it like this. "O Isis und Osiris schenket," breathe, "der Weisheit Geist im neuen Paar." So the words in English mean, "O Isis and Osiris, give the spirit of wisdom to the new couple." Well, it only makes grammatical sense if you breathe "O Isis und Osiris," comma, honour that comma, "schenket der Weisheit Geist im neuen Paar."
Do you encourage singers to perform both Lieder and opera? Does one help the other?
Yes. I mean, if you just sing Lieder, the temptation is to stand in the well of the piano, look romantic, give us a huge amount of interpretation and absolutely no tone. Conversely, if you're an opera singer, you ought to sing Lieder because it helps you to articulate text instead of just giving a stream of sound. So it cuts both ways.
Yeah. Mahler next.
I've chosen this Urlicht because at the Academy, Jonathan Freeman Atwood, the principal, invites some of the world's greatest conductors to work with the students. And we've had people like Trevor Pinnock, Mark Elder, Edward Gardner, and then Simeon Bitchkopf conducted Mahler's Second Symphony. At the Royal Festival Hall, I counted 250 students in the Royal Academy on stage. It must have changed their lives. And I've chosen Sarah Connolly. There's such a stillness about this. And again, perfect diction.
Thank you.
Sarah Connolly singing the fourth movement, Ohlicht, from Mahler's Symphony No. 2, the Resurrection Symphony. The Philharmonia Orchestra was conducted by Benjamin Zander. I'm Michael Barclay, and you're listening to Private Passions on BBC Radio 3 with my guest today, Richard Stokes, who's Professor of Lieder at the Royal Academy of Music. Richard, one of the key means of teaching your students must be through master classes.
Yes, and some people are very good at giving master classes and some people are less good. It seems to me it's inappropriate to impose an interpretation.
Well, I'm very interested you say that, because my next question is where you stand on fidelity to a composer's markings and the score.
It is crucial that you try and follow the composer's markings. But when you're performing song, you have to perform with inner conviction. And you might see the poem in a different light to the composer. And they're not mutually exclusive necessarily. I mean, there are lots of examples of composers too. If you listen to Stravinsky conducting his own score of The Rite of Spring, he doesn't follow the markings always at all. And who's to say that if you do different markings to what Schubert wanted, that Schubert mightn't have liked it? I think you always have to try and follow what they say. But I can give you examples. Brigitte Fassbinder, when she sings the second of the Brahms Four Serious Songs, and you have the phrase, not aware of all the evil that's done in the world, here on earth beneath the sun. Brahms writes a hairpin, so it's a crescendo and then a decrescendo. Brigitte just ignores it and sings it with enormous venom and passion as criticism against humanity.
And if I might just put in a thought as a composer here, yeah. I'm always interested in what other people will bring to the music. And if they, you know, that's what makes it or breaks it sometimes. I feel if somebody can bring something I hadn't even thought of possibly, and it can be transforming.
I think not everybody's like you.
Your next music, Richard Stokes, is by Bach, from one of his cantatas.
Well, I've chosen this because one of the exciting things at the Royal Academy of Music is once a month on Sundays, we performed every single one of Bach cantatas. And I just wanted to choose this Sinfonia from the BWV 29. It was composed, I think, in 1731. But in 1749, Bach's health was declining. And what did the authorities in Dresden and Leipzig do? They looked around for a successor. That got leaked to Bach. And so what did he do in 1749? He was able to perform this, sort of as two fingers, you know, to the Council of Leipzig. I can still do it. Listen to this music. And I like to think that it was he who was playing the organ on that occasion. This bravura organ playing. I mean, it's so exciting. And to be in the Duke's Hall and 420 people packed listening to this and our students taking part, it's so exciting.
What a joyous noise.
Astonishing, and to be part of this. I mean, just imagine what it's like to be a student there.
That was the opening sinfonia from Bach's Cantata No. 29, Wir danken dir Gott, We Thank You, God, performed by Collegium Vocale Ghent, conducted by Philippe Herreweger. The organist was Hermann Stinders. Richard Stokes, you've published your own English translations of the texts of all the Bach cantatas, as well as the many songs and operas you've translated. The Oxford Leader website has thousands of your song translations online. What do you think essentially draws you to the art of translating? I mean, as a non-performer, is it somehow a way in which you are performing?
Well, let's put it very generously. I mean, faut mieux, I can't do anything else. I learned the piano, and I got to grade 5. I started the violin and played the cello. I just wasn't very good at it. But I love music so much. So one way I can contribute is to translate these things. And I love poetry.
And of course, the wonderful thing is there's no retirement age for this. I mean, no. You're approaching 80 now, but you can keep going, can't you?
Apparently. They keep telling me that.
Most of the music you've chosen today is from the established canon of well-known composers, but your final choice is by a lesser-known 19th-century composer, a contemporary of Schubert and Schumann. And if I were to say to people we're going to hear a song cycle, Fraun Lieber, they would think I was talking about somebody else, wouldn't they?
They would. And this composer is Karl Löwe, born a year before Schubert in 1796, died much, much later in 1869. He is not considered by most people to be in the top 10 leader composers of the 19th century. This is a disgrace. He is, and this is why I've just written the book, Karl Löwe, Song Companion, that's going to be published by Bitten Press and launched at Wigmore Hall. Most singers will know the ballads like Elkönig, Tom der Reimer, Herr Uluf. But he was also a great leader composer. And his Frauenliebe was composed 4 years before Schumann's in 1836. It's got one extra song. It's complete, in other words, that Schumann didn't set. And it is miraculous. But why he's also important, he's important in the realm of comic song. All singers ought to leaven their recitals with comedy, else you come across as so dour and serious. And he and Wolf, you know, they're masters in that genre. But this Frauenliebe, this An meinem Herzen, An meiner Brust, I think Schumann doesn't quite get it. It's a helter-skelter setting. This is a lullaby. And so you are a young woman and you have your child at your breast, and you sing him or her this song. This is sung by Brigitte Fassbinder, and at the end you'll hear her humming. And so I asked her, I often sit on song juries with her and I've got to know her, so why did you do this? Is it in the score? She said, no, it's not in the score at all, but it just seemed right. I think it's wonderful. My first daughter, Tabitha, she wouldn't sleep when she was a baby, so I made her C90 recordings of all my favourite lullabies. This always worked. This shut her up and she fell asleep.
Well, I'm afraid now it's time for me to shut you up, Richard Stokes, and it just remains for me to say thank you very much indeed.
It's such a pleasure being here. Thank you.
Thank you.
A lullaby from Karl Löwe's Frauenliebe, Woman's Love, sung by Brigitte Fassbinder with the pianist Kurt Garben. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, the art song expert Richard Stokes. The programme was produced by Graham Rogers. Next week, Michael's guest will be the historical novelist Philippa Gregory.
BBC Radio 3, the home of live classical music.
All this week, don't miss your chance to hear incredible performances from the BBC orchestras, including
Mahler's Alpine-inspired First Symphony,
Bartok's suspense-filled Bluebeard's Castle,
plus Copland's Appalachian Spring.
Experience the best concerts throughout the week, every week.
Radio 3 in concert, Monday to Thursday evenings from 7:30.
Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's coming up to 1:30. Hello from me, Jane Royce. I'll be guiding you through the rest of the day here on Radio 3. Well, it's now time for Sarah Moore-Peach to work her way towards a very welcome, sun-drenched musical destination.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map. No music exists in a vacuum. Every piece is part of the web of life, connected to other sounds from across the planet and through time, and to the life of the person who created it. This is España, a short, ebullient orchestral fantasy by the 19th century French composer Emmanuel Chabrier, which he wrote after a tour of Spain. And we'll hear it at the end of our show. Between now and our destination, we'll explore this piece through some of those musical connections, some obvious, others more tangential, as a way of hearing it afresh. And we're going to start today's listening journey very close to where we'll end it, with another of Chabrier's Spanish-infused works, a sultry habanera.